Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de la región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Comprensión de textos orales. Nivel C2. Convocatoria, junio 2019.
In today's episode, we hear from student Tamana. Tamana and her family have been racially abused throughout their lives. Here's her story.
I've had a long-standing history with racism, bullying, Islamophobia and discrimination. And it all really started when I was in school, in primary school and preschool. I was the only Asian young girl in my area and also in my primary school. And I was always singled out for my skin colour, my culture, my family, my background. And people didn't like us at all because they thought we were strange and odd. And they were always telling us, oh, go back home where you belong. You know, you don't deserve to be here. You know, so we felt very unwelcome in our own community. And I was a very shy, quiet child. I had no friends. My parents didn't really understand the language very well. You know, my mum was a housewife, my father was a businessman. He had a curry restaurant business and people would buy curry from him and they'd throw back at his windows. So his windows would be stained with curry and that wasn't very pleasant. Whatever name they could think of, they would call it, you know, F off back home and, you know, go and burn a microwave, no one likes you, you know, go and kill yourself and... You know, you name it, I'd have everything under the sun, every name under the sun. They call you the P word and they tell you to, you know, you don't belong here and no one likes you, everyone hates you, no one likes your family. I mean, you're a terrorist, you know, whatever. People used to follow us home, they'd throw stuff into our letterbox, they'd mess up our garden. There was one time I had a friend and her stepsister didn't like me, so they used to beat me up all the time, wait for me after school, at lunchtime, break time. They'd kick me to the point where I'd have a massive scar on my leg, and even 8-9 years on later, I've still got that scar on my leg, and every time I look down at it, it reminds me of the childhood memories of being beaten in the playground. So it's not very pleasant at all. People would push me off the wall, pull my hair, they'd throw milk back at me, so I'd be smelling of milk all day. You know, they'd make my life an absolute misery, and I absolutely hated school. I always used to cry and become very emotional, upset, and very vulnerable, as a young child would. I'd report it to the din ladies and the teachers, and they wouldn't really do anything about it, because they think, oh, you're being silly, you know, it's a joke. Even parents were like, you know, don't go near her, or don't, you know, their family, because, you know, they're not one of us. And it was quite difficult for me, because... You know, English wasn't my first language. I wasn't born here. I was born in Bangladesh. We're Muslim. We're very cultured and kind of strict sort of background that I come from. Back in the day, it was more about skin colour, culture and family and where you're from. And then I feel now it's more about racism as in religious racism and religious discrimination and, you know, the terror attacks that we've had recently and different current affairs. And I feel like that's had a massive influence, especially when I was growing up in, you know, secondary school. I had the issue of going to an all-girls school, and it was very, very strict where everyone had to wear the same uniform, everyone had to wear blazers and skirts. And because I'm from a very conservative background, my parents didn't allow skirts. I had to wear trousers. So we had an ongoing fight with the school to allow me to wear trousers because of religious reasons, and the school didn't agree with me wearing it, and it was very, very difficult. I was allowed to wear it for a term, and then suddenly I was told, you're not allowed to wear these trousers anymore because they're too tight, which was a massive lie because they did a random surprise spot check and they said, if you didn't wear a skirt by next term, then I'm afraid you're not really welcome here. So unfortunately, we had to give in and we had to get a long skirt, and the bullying continued because people again singled me out because, oh, you're wearing a long skirt, oh, you're wearing trousers, oh, you're a special case and this and that. So it was very, very difficult. I had a lot of cyberbullying as well. So people would, you know, you'd come home from school or, you know, university, and people would be commenting or harassing you online or messaging you or commenting on your photos, and it just wouldn't be very nice. And I'd have to report them, and still they'd find you on another form of social media. The story just goes on and on and on. And also in university, I really struggled. You know, I lived, you know, in my first year, I lived in a house and...
In today's episode, we hear from student Tamana. Tamana and her family have been racially abused throughout their lives. Here's her story.
I've had a long-standing history with racism, bullying, Islamophobia and discrimination. And it all really started when I was in school, in primary school and preschool. I was the only Asian young girl in my area and also in my primary school, and I was always singled out for my skin colour, my culture, my family, my background, and people didn't like us at all because they thought we were strange and odd, and they were always telling us, oh, go back home where you belong, you know, you don't deserve to be here, you know. So we felt very unwelcome in our own community, and I was a very shy, quiet child. I had no friends. My parents didn't really understand the language very well. You know, my mum was a housewife, my father was a businessman. He had a curry restaurant business, and people would buy curry from him and they'd throw back at his windows. So his windows would be stained with curry, and that wasn't very pleasant. Whatever name they could think of, they would call it, you know, F off back home, and, you know, go and burn a microwave, no one likes you, you know, go and kill yourself, and... you know, you name it, I'd have everything under the sun, every name under the sun. They call you the P word, and they tell you to, you know, you don't belong here, and no one likes you, everyone hates you, no one likes your family, I mean, you're a terrorist, you know, whatever. People used to follow us home, they'd throw stuff into our letterbox, they'd mess up our garden. There was one time I had a friend and her stepsister didn't like me, so they used to beat me up all the time, wait for me after school, at lunchtime, break time. They'd kick me to the point where I'd have a massive scar on my leg, and even 8-9 years on later, I've still got that scar on my leg, and every time I look down into it, it reminds me of the childhood memories of being beaten in the playground. So it's not very pleasant at all. People would push me off the wall, pull my hair, they'd throw milk back at me, so I'd be smelling of milk all day. You know, they'd make my life an absolute misery, and I absolutely hated school. I always used to cry and become very emotional, upset, and very vulnerable, as a young child would. I'd report it to the din ladies and the teachers, and they wouldn't really do anything about it, because they think, oh, you're being silly, you know, it's a joke. Even parents were like, you know, don't go near her, or don't, you know, their family, because, you know, they're not one of us. And it was quite difficult for me, because... you know, English wasn't my first language. I wasn't born here. I was born in Bangladesh. We're Muslim, but a very cultured and kind of strict sort of background that I come from. Back in the day, it was more about skin colour, culture and family and where you're from. And then I feel now it's more about racism as in religious racism and religious discrimination and, you know, the terror attacks that we've had recently and different current affairs. And I feel like that's had a massive influence, especially when I was growing up in, you know, secondary school. I had the issue of going to an all-girls school, and it was very, very strict, where everyone had to wear the same uniform, everyone had to wear blazers and skirts. And because I'm from a very conservative background, my parents didn't allow skirts. I had to wear trousers. So we had an ongoing fight with the school to allow me to wear trousers because of religious reasons, and the school didn't agree with me wearing it, and it was very, very difficult. I was allowed to wear it for a term, and then suddenly I was told, you're not allowed to wear these trousers anymore because they're too tight, which was a massive lie, because they did a random surprise spot check and they said, if you didn't wear a skirt by next term, then I'm afraid you're not really welcome here. So unfortunately, we had to give in and we had to get a long skirt. And the bullying continued because people again singled me out because, oh, you're wearing a long skirt, oh, you're wearing trousers, oh, you're a special case and this and that. So it was very, very difficult. I had a lot of cyberbullying as well. So people would, you know, you'd come home from school or, you know, university, and people would be commenting or harassing you online or messaging you or commenting on your photos, and it just wouldn't be very nice. And I'd have to report them, and still they'd find you on another form of social media. The story just goes on and on and on. And also in university, I really struggled. You know, I lived, you know, in my first year, I lived in a house and...
You know, I got my teeth whitened today, and the actually, as it was happening, I was regretting it.
Because people don't understand that shit hurts.
It fucking hurts.
And we live in Los Angeles, where you need to have air conditioning. You can't even smile because
is it going to hurt like this forever?
No, it'll toughen up.
Yeah,
but it's honest to God, even when you do like some of the whitening.
Yeah, whitening strips.
Mm-hmm. And that's, yours is amplified by 20, you know, whatever you're thinking, 20 times more. On
because I had the laser.
Because you had the lights.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not, it won't be, it probably could be gone tomorrow, the sensitivity. Okay. In the next few days, my recommendation, I do this anyway because I got my teeth are sensitive on things. I rinse my mouth out with warm water. I can't do cold water when I brush my teeth.
Right.
So use warm I will. Water.
Anyway, so I went in to get my teeth whitened because the fake teeth, these two back here, what are these called? Not the
incisors?
I don't know what these are.
The incisors.
Well,
think.
These are what?
Molars?
No,
those aren't molars yet.
Yeah. Anyway, these are fake teeth, and when I photograph, they are super white. So I thought, you know, I went to my doctor and said, "Look, I want you to change out."
Oh, those are implants.
Yeah.
So you had to get your human teeth to match your humanoid teeth.
He said, I want you to change out the fake teeth to match the human teeth." And he said, "Well, why don't you just whiten your human teeth?" Oh. I said, "I guess that's why you are a doctor."
Correct.
Exactly.
And I am a plebeian.
And that's right.
Yeah.
So I went in today and I had the real teeth, the ones that came out of my body.
Right.
I have the receipts.
Thank you, Jesus.
They are the ones that I walked up into the club with and had them whitened. Yeah. And
the pain is real.
The pain is real.
Yeah.
It was real.
It's not pain like, ow, it's just so sensitive you can't do anything.
Yeah.
How was it when you ate your nuts earlier?
My nuts are fine. I thought you'd never ask. But listen to this. I was thanking Jesus. I was thanking Jesus.
I'll tell Lola.
That I had my coffee that morning.
Oh, bitch. First of all, you just whiten them. You can't do coffee until
48 hours.
Yes.
I said, excuse me?
She don't know who they talking to.
I said, what did you call me?
Do they know that you are Java
you
addict?
Know that I am Java Joe in my spare time.
Bitch, yes.
So I'm going to have my coffee with a straw, bitch, because.
Oh, you can wait 2 days.
Can I?
You can.
Can I really?
Is there an anal option? Yeah, there is an anal option.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do.
You're going to deal with it. It's 48 hours. You spent that money and the time and the pain to get them done.
It was a lot. I think it cost me $650.
No, it ain't cheap.
$650.
But it's worth it because they look beautiful.
Are they white?
They're really
white. Yeah.
And you're wearing white today. Like
I'm wearing white today.
Full C.
Full white. Full C. Yeah. It was, the pain is weird because I had about 3 more minutes to go and I said, y'all better come get this machine
shut up,
off
really?
Of me. Yeah. 3 more minutes to go. You know, I got my teeth whitened today, and actually, as it was happening, I was regretting it.
Because people don't understand that shit hurts.
It fucking hurts.
And we live in Los Angeles, where you need to have air conditioning. You can't even smile because
is it going to hurt like this forever?
No, it'll toughen up.
Yeah,
but it's honestly, honest to God, even when you do like some of the whitening.
Yeah, whitening strips.
Mm-hmm, and that's. Yours is amplified by 20, you know, whatever you're thinking 20 times more. On
because
your,
I had the laser.
Because you had the lights.
Yeah.
They're not, it won't be, it probably could be gone tomorrow, the sensitivity.
Okay.
In the next few days, my recommendation, I do this anyway because I got my teeth are sensitive on things.
Mm-hmm.
I rinse my mouth out with warm water. I can't do cold water when I brush my teeth.
Right.
So use warm
I will.
Water.
Anyway, so I went in to get my teeth whitened because the fake teeth, these two back here, what are these called? Not the
incisors?
I don't know what these are.
The incisors.
Well,
I think.
These are what?
Molars?
Those aren't molars yet.
Yeah. Anyway, these are fake teeth, and when I photograph, they are super white. So I thought, you know, I went to my doctor and said, "Look, I want you to change out."
Oh, those are implants.
Yeah.
So you had to get your human teeth. To match your humanoid teeth.
He said, I said, I want you to change out the fake teeth to match the human teeth. And he said, well, why don't you just whiten your human teeth?
Oh.
I said, I guess that's why you are a doctor.
Correct.
Exactly.
And I am a plebeian.
And that's right.
Yeah.
So I went in today and I had the real teeth, the ones that came out of my body.
Right.
I have the receipts.
Thank you, Jesus.
They are the ones that I walked up into the club with. And had them whitened. Yeah. And
the pain is real.
The pain is real.
Yeah.
It was real.
It's not pain like, ow, it's just so sensitive you can't do anything.
Yeah.
How was it when you ate your nuts earlier?
My nuts are fine. I thought you'd never ask. But listen to this. I was thanking Jesus. I was thanking Jesus.
I'll tell Lola.
That I had my coffee that morning.
Oh, bitch. First of all, you just whiten them. You can't do coffee until
48 hours.
Yes.
I said, excuse me?
She don't know who they talking to.
I said, what did you call me?
Do they know that you are Java
you
addict?
Know that I am Java Joe in my spare time.
Bitch, yes.
So I'm going to have my coffee with a straw, bitch, because.
Oh, you can wait 2 days.
Can I?
You can.
Can I really?
Is there an anal option? Yeah, there is.
Yeah, there is an anal option. Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do.
You're going to deal with it. It's 48 hours. You spent that money and the time and the pain to get them done.
It was a lot. I think it cost me $650.
No, it ain't cheap.
$650.
But it's worth it because they look beautiful.
Are they white?
They're really white.
Yeah.
And you're wearing white today. Like
I'm wearing white today.
Full C.
Full white. Full C. Yeah. It was, the pain is weird because I had about 3 more minutes to go and I said, y'all better come get this machine
shut
off,
up,
off
really?
Of me. Yeah. 3 more minutes to go.
We're seeing the new sharing economy. Companies like Uber and Airbnb, those headquartered in San Francisco, not only changing the nature of employment and lifestyle, but they've also ushered in new million and billionaires wielding influence both socially, economically, and politically. Who are these people? How did they make it so big? How do they and their ideas end up having such incredible influence on our lives? We're going to ask all of those questions of Bloomberg technology editor Brad Stone, author of a new book called The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley are Changing the World. Brad Stone, thanks for joining us on In Depth. I appreciate it.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I loved how you just put that all in historic perspective.
Well, I showed my age there for one thing, but that tees it up for you to tell us about how you looked at these new job sharing companies and where they fit in the history of the region's economy and now the world. In your book, you focus on Uber and Airbnb as the two giants and the individual, the personalities behind it who've come out of this on top. What made them the success stories? How did they navigate the policy issues in all of these cities, rules, regulations, taxes, and as you said, entrenched business interests of hotels, taxis, airport services? This could have been, and in some cities is still being argued, a logistical nightmare that could have killed off other companies getting off the ground like this.
And it did. There were predecessors in ride sharing and home sharing that did not succeed because they ran into, you know, regulatory obstacles and gave up. So I think a couple things had to happen. One, you know, and it's the character of these entrepreneurs that they are sort of hard-driving, ferocious. I think we can safely say that in the case of Uber, you know, and Travis Kalanick, the CEO, you know, they kind of bowled over the obstacles that were in his way. He did not ask for permission in major cities. He sort of begged for forgiveness somewhat afterward. It helped that customers embraced his product. And when he would have trouble in cities like Washington, D.C. or New York, you know, they would email their customers and say, you know, if you want Uber to stay in your city and if you want it to be legal, then send the city council people an email. And it turned out, at least early on, that people loved this service so much they would come out in support of it. Airbnb was very similar. You know, it was illegal in some places just because of older laws around illegal hoteling and zoning ordinances. And, you know, they kind of launched quietly. They did not, let's just say, go out of their way to warn their customers that these things might be illegal. But they grew. They amassed political power. They hired some very clever and experienced lobbyists. And then they went and tried to change the law from the inside.
So for those who didn't make it, what did they do wrong? Or going back to your previous answer, was it just the tenacity of these individuals that we're going to talk about next, their personalities?
Yeah, no, I think there were a couple of things they did wrong. One, in some cases, they were a little too early. So you could not launch a ride-sharing service successfully on the BlackBerry.
Right.
It didn't have everything you need, the connectivity, the GPS. But I think That's letting them off the hook to say they were too early. These successful businesses need a combination of idealism and ruthlessness. And in some cases, they would have too much of one and not the other. So, for example, there was a survey.
We're seeing the new sharing economy. Companies like Uber and Airbnb, those headquartered in San Francisco, not only changing the nature of employment and lifestyle, but they've also ushered in new million and billionaires wielding influence both socially, economically, and politically. Who are these people? How did they make it so big? How do they and their ideas end up having such incredible influence on our lives? We're going to ask all of those questions of Bloomberg technology editor Brad Stone, author of a new book called The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley are Changing the World. Brad Stone, thanks for joining us on In Depth. I appreciate it.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I loved how you just put that all in historic perspective.
Well, I showed my age there for one thing, but that tees it up for you to tell us about how you looked at these new job sharing companies and where they fit in the history of the region's economy and now the world. In your book, you focus on Uber and Airbnb as the two giants and the individual, the personalities behind it who've come out of this on top. What made them the success stories? How did they navigate the policy issues in all of these cities, rules, regulations, taxes, and as you said, entrenched business interests of hotels, taxis, airport services? This could have been, and in some cities is still being argued, a logistical nightmare that could have killed off other companies getting off the ground like this.
And it did. There were predecessors in ride sharing and home sharing that did not succeed because they ran into, you know, regulatory obstacles and gave up. So I think a couple things had to happen. One, you know, and it's the character of these entrepreneurs that they are sort of hard driving, ferocious. I think we can safely say that in the case of Uber, you know, and Travis Kalanick, the CEO, you know, they kind of bowled over the obstacles that were in his way. He did not ask for permission in major cities. He sort of begged for forgiveness somewhat afterward. It helped that customers embraced his product. And when he would have trouble in cities like Washington, D.C. or New York, you know, they would email their customers and say, you know, if you want Uber to stay in your city and if you want it to be legal, then send the city council people an email. And it turned out, at least early on, that people loved this service so much they would come out in support of it. Airbnb was very similar. You know, it was illegal in some places just because of older laws around illegal hoteling and zoning ordinances. And, you know, they kind of launched quietly. They did not, let's just say, go out of their way to warn their customers that these things might be illegal. But they grew. They amassed political power. They hired some very clever and experienced lobbyists. And then they went and tried to change the law from the inside.
So for those who didn't make it, what did they do wrong? Or going back to your previous answer, was it just the tenacity of these individuals that we're going to talk about next, their personalities?
Yeah, no, I think there were a couple of things they did wrong. One, in some cases, they were a little too early. So you could not launch a ride-sharing service successfully on the BlackBerry.
Right.
It didn't have everything you need, the connectivity, the GPS. But I think That's letting them off the hook to say they were too early. These successful businesses need a combination of idealism and ruthlessness. And in some cases, they would have too much of one and not the other. So, for example, there was a service.
Fin de la prueba.